Today is Tuesday, the 24th of August, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Evacuations from Kabul surpasses 37,000, while the United States says it's continuing to reach out to partners.
We are trying to get as many of them to the airport as quickly as possible to get them on flights home.
As one former diplomat criticizes America's performance in Afghanistan.
The losers, the United States, the people of Afghanistan, the majority of the people of Afghanistan.
Plus, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration gives full approval to the Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine. These stories and more next. The United States has nearly doubled the number of people evacuated from Afghanistan during the past 24 hours as it races to complete its withdrawal from the country by President Joe Biden's August 31st deadline. Monday, the White House said that more than 37,000 people have been flown out since the Taliban militants took control of Afghanistan after its U.S.-backed government collapsed more than a week ago. But just how many Americans remain stuck in Afghanistan is murky. Biden administration National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan was questioned by reporters at the White House Monday about efforts to reach Americans.
What we have done is we have put out through multiple different means, telephone, email, text, and publicly on radio, online, through every possible, both broadcast and targeted means possible to Americans who may potentially be in Afghanistan. Please respond. Please contact us. Please tell us your location. Please tell us if you'd like to leave. Please tell us how many there are with you. So we've gone through that process. And then we've done a series of calls through all of the folks who responded to then have a refined conversation with each of them. We have tried to take that and then match it up against a plan to, as I said before, put Americans into groups to efficiently transfer them onto the airfield. But, of course, when you're trying to ultimately determine a precise fixed number, that is a dynamic and ongoing process. It's ongoing today. It will be ongoing tomorrow.
Tensions at the airport in Kabul have been rising, with tens of thousands of Afghans trying to get out of the country now that it's under Taliban control. Many have said it has been difficult, if not impossible, to get past Taliban checkpoints. There have also been reports that supplies of food and water at the airport have been running low. There are also concerns about conditions becoming so unsanitary that some Afghans have left the airport. Security around the airport's perimeter has also been tested, most recently when an unidentified assailant opened fire on Afghan forces guarding the gates, killing an Afghan soldier. As that August 31st deadline approaches for American forces to leave Afghanistan, VOA White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman pressed officials.
Whether it's August 31st or shortly thereafter, it's clear that all of the eligible Afghans who work for U.S. forces and the U.S. government are not going to be able to get out. For those watching, what do you say to them? What advice do you give? Should they try to get to a third country on their own? Should they wait for some diplomatic solution?
So first, we're in touch with the Afghans at risk, eligible for special immigrant visas and other categories of support from the U.S. government. We are trying to get as many of them to the airport as quickly as possible to get them on flights home. And as I said yesterday in comments on the Sunday shows, we will continue to get Afghans at risk out of the country even after U.S. military forces have left.
Sullivan also said that the administration is in talks with the Taliban on a daily basis through both political and security channels. Monday afternoon, Sky News reported that one person on Britain's no-fly list had been evacuated from Kabul and transported to the United Kingdom. It's unclear what happened to the person, and government officials did not elaborate on the specifics of the incident, only saying that thorough checks are taking place. President Biden will also meet virtually with other Group of Seven or G7 leaders on Tuesday to discuss Afghanistan. One of the topics that's on the agenda is whether or not to request an extension to the end of the month deadline to process evacuations, something that the Taliban has said is a red line it's not willing to cross. Despite assurances from the Biden administration that a certain level of chaos was to be expected as the U.S. withdrew its troops, criticism continues. VOA Urdu 360 host Sarah Zaman sat down for an exclusive interview with former Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage, who says that while the decision to leave Afghanistan was the right one, the manner in which it was carried out was awful.
I expected us to be out of Afghanistan years and years and years ago. In fact, I'm sure we would be out if we hadn't turned our attention to Iraq. And having turned the administration's attention to Iraq, I think that Afghanistan was more or less put on automatic pilot. It was a stupid idea. When the U.S. administration goes all in to win, we can prevail. But if we don't go all in with all our resources, we will fail.
But 20 years and roughly $2 trillion. How else did you define going all in? If this wasn't going all in, what does it then even look like?
Going all in for me would have meant not only the military application of force, but the application of all of our diplomatic political strength to root out corruption. The reason that we had the swift fall of Kabul was not because Afghans can't fight, but the fact is the government in Kabul was not worth the sacrifice of those soldiers because the government was so corrupt.
So now when you see Taliban pretty much in control of Afghanistan again, what goes through your mind?
First thing I think about is who's the winner and the losers. Taliban, winners. Pakistan is a winner. Iran is a winner. China and Russia, they like the fact that we seem to be confused and diffident right now and on our back heels. But they're going to be very careful in their dealings, I think, with the people and the government of Afghanistan. The losers, United States, the people of Afghanistan, the majority of the people of Afghanistan, and India.
How so?
Well, Pakistan has accomplished what's always been our objective, and that is to have strategic depth vis-a-vis India. So now things, from a Pakistan government point of view, are back in normal. They've got strategic depth vis-a-vis India. And it has been my experience in dealing with ISI 24/7. India was on their mind.
How should the U.S. manage its relations with an Afghanistan that's led by Taliban?
It's not being led by the Taliban. It's how they lead, to what end, that matters. My own view is we'll judge them and our own stance vis-a-vis Afghanistan by how they lead and if they are inclusive of all segments, Hazara, Tajik, women, Pashtun, everyone, whether they have a more benign version of Sharia law or not. That will dictate, it would seem to me, the way the United States approaches them.
The president has talked about over-the-horizon capabilities, that this is how the U.S. is now going to manage its counterterrorism operations. Do you not think that that would be successful?
No. You to have over-the-horizon capabilities, you have to have a knowledge of what's going on over the horizon. And if we don't have people and they don't have intelligence sources, then how can we know what's going on over the horizon? So if you just say the U.S. can drop bombs, that's true.
And how do you think this should or this might affect any foreign intervention by the United States in the future?
I would like to say it would make us more thoughtful about foreign intervention. I think in the region, we've had enough for now, but foreign intervention more generally, there are cases that call for intervention. Panama, for instance, when we had to go to protect our citizens, or the Balkans, which I've mentioned. So I wouldn't say it's the end of foreign interventions, but in the region, yeah.
Richard Armitage was the former Deputy Secretary of State under both Presidents Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush. He was speaking to VOA Urdu 360 host Sarah Zaman. The World Health Organization and UNICEF are calling for the establishment of a humanitarian air bridge to deliver life-saving assistance to millions of vulnerable people in Afghanistan. Lisa Schlein has that part of our coverage.
Since the Taliban seized control of Afghanistan, major air operations at Kabul Airport have been focused on evacuating internationals and vulnerable Afghans. This operation has gone ahead at the expense of aid deliveries by UN agencies. For example, the World Health Organization reports it was unable to deliver 500 tons of medical supplies this week, including surgical equipment, trauma medicines, and treatment treatments for childhood pneumonia because of Kabul airport restrictions. Spokesman for the UN Children's Fund, James Elder, tells VOA the WHO shipment also included nutritional food for the treatment of malnourished children.
We fear that you could have as many as 1 million children under the age of 5 suffering from severe acute malnutrition this year. That's the most dangerous form. That's the type of malnutrition that kills. We need to continually ensure that those supplies are on the ground. And a lot of that does take airlifts. Now we have a lot of supplies in country, but it's not an exhaustive amount. We need to continually replenish those.
That, he explains, is why WHO and UNICEF are calling for the establishment of a humanitarian air bridge. He says this would ensure that life-saving supplies could come into the country while evacuations were taking place. Elder notes that conditions in Afghanistan are perilous. He says humanitarian needs remain as critical now as they were before this conflict came to a head. Even before the current crisis, he says Afghanistan represented the third largest humanitarian operation in the world. Since no commercial aircraft currently can land in Kabul, he says a humanitarian air bridge would allow aircraft delivering aid to continue to use the airport.
It just requires authorities on the ground to ensure that humanitarian agencies, the big ones that do these types of things, World Food Program, UNICEF, and of course what we're talking here with regard to these medicines, WHO, it's what they do day in, day out in inverted commas, normal times, and it just needs to continue now, despite what look like chaotic scenes at that airport.
The United Nations reports that nearly half of Afghanistan's population, or 18 million people, among them 10 million children, require life-saving assistance. This number includes 300,000 people who fled their homes in the last 2 months, while Taliban insurgents were closing in on the country's former rulers. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration has given full approval to Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine for people 16 and older. Associated Press reporter Shelley Adler is up next.
This is a pivotal moment for our country in the fight against the pandemic.
Acting FDA Commissioner Janet Woodcock.
We want to underscore that our efforts to move as quickly as possible have in no way sacrificed scientific standards or the integrity of our process.
And she's hoping the approval will push more people to get the vaccine.
For some, an FDA-approved COVID vaccine may instill in them the confidence to go and get vaccinated.
I'm Shelley Adler.
Delaware State University's Donna Patterson now joins us to discuss the FDA-Pfizer announcement and its implications for vaccine inequality. Patterson is a professor and chair of DSU's Department of History, Political Science, and Philosophy, as well as the director for Africana Studies.
I think it's a welcome move. It's much more likely now that people who are vaccine hesitant, who've been waiting for FDA approval, that they will now sign up to get vaccinated. There's a flip argument there, too, because I've already seen some social media saying, okay, now it's approved, it's about profits, and so there's this other move for another reason not to take it. However, despite that, I think that a lot of people who were on the fence, who were hesitant, who were reticent, now are more likely to go ahead and do it. With this new FDA approval, I knew that there would be new vaccine mandates at the federal, corporate, and institutional level. We're already seeing that.
You know, in terms of now that this is an FDA-approved vaccine, you know, what do you see as the implications in terms of getting more vaccines out to people who do not have it? It's not an issue of hesitancy, which, as you alluded to, could be quelled because now this is an approved drug. But, you know, there simply isn't vaccines getting to those who need it.
Absolutely. I'm going to look at that both domestically and internationally. Because I think when you're thinking about equity, we have to also think about what's happening in this country. We're seeing kind of two groups of people who aren't taking vaccines largely. Those who are vaccine hesitant and those who are anti-vax. And I think even within there, you have kind of multiple strains of people. So the reasons that people aren't taking them, even though they're they're hesitant in different ways. Now, I think with FDA approvals, this will help. But globally, I think this is a major issue. And if we see that most of the world is not vaccinated. Most of the people who are vaccinated live in the West and in some cases, certain Western countries. But a lot of the world, including the African continent, has low vaccination rates. Right now, the African continent averages about 2%, and there's a great dearth. And what we've seen in recent weeks was that COVAX finally started scaling up again. The U.S. government was working with one of U.S. government, U.K., France, and some other countries have been working closer with the COVAX partners to get more vaccines into African countries. But now, with rising demand in the U.S., will that continue?
So in your opinion, what do you think is a possible remedy for that?
A couple of things. I think sharing the technology, helping scale up vaccine production sites in different parts of the world. Because right now, for instance, in India, they produce a lot of AstraZeneca. You know, there's talk of having some of the mRNA vaccine produced on the African continent. There have been a few countries that have been pegged, Rwanda, Senegal, South Africa. I can't think of the others off the top of my head right now. And that's great. But right now, that production would probably not start until the late 2022 or early 2023. That's too late. You know, is there a way to scale that up quickly, have that production there, have it and distribute it throughout the continent, even if they can get two or three of those sites? Both they could help, you know, vaccinating Africa, but also vaccinating other parts of the world, parts of the Middle East, parts of Asia, parts of Latin America, Caribbean, that still need a lot of vaccine. Also, if we're thinking of this long term, with the numbers of variants that we've seen, we're probably going to see strains. And so we're probably going to have to see, you know, some new generations of vaccines for the foreseeable future. So that needs to be there now.
Donna Patterson teaches at Delaware State University. She is the chair of the Department of History, Political Science, and Philosophy, as well as the director of Africana Studies. The United States does not have hostile intent towards Pyongyang and is open to meeting anytime and any place. That's according to Washington's special envoy for North Korea, who said that on Monday during a visit to South Korea. Reuters' Jason Albano reports.
The U.S. and South Korea want to bring North Korea back into talks to denuclearize. On Monday, Washington's special envoy for North Korea, Song Kim, met with his counterpart in Seoul. His visit comes amid a simmering new standoff over Washington and Seoul's annual joint military exercises that Pyongyang warned could trigger a security crisis. The North sees these exercises as a rehearsal for war against it. But Kim tried to tamp down that tension.
The United States does not have hostile intent towards the DPRK. The ongoing U.S.-ROK combined military exercises are longstanding, routine, and purely defensive in nature, and support the security of both of our countries.
He also urged Pyongyang to come to the table.
I continue to stand ready to meet with my North Korean counterparts anywhere at any time. On the importance of the U.S.-ROK alliance, I cannot put it better than President Biden himself, who called the U.S. commitment to the defense of the Republic of Korea sacred.
A brief thaw in relations between the two Koreas in June saw a hotline between the two reopen last month. That was a year after North Korea suspended them. But the moment didn't last. After preliminary training for the exercises began last week, the North stopped answering the phone. State media in Pyongyang has so far also been silent since the start of the drills. That's despite fears that the country could conduct a missile test or take other actions to display its disapproval.
Jason Albano from Reuters News. The United States imposed sanctions Monday on a top Eritrean defense official, citing Eritrea's actions during the conflict in Ethiopia's Tigray region. The Treasury Department said in a statement that sanctioning Filipos Waldenhayes, the chief of staff of the Eritrean Defense Force, or EDF, accusing the forces of carrying out abuses in Tigray. The Treasury Department said the EDF engaged in despicable acts in Tigray, including massacres, looting, and sexual assaults. An internal U.S. Capitol Police investigation has exonerated one of its officers in the fatal shooting of a woman inside the U.S. Capitol building on January 6th, as she and hundreds of supporters of then-President Donald Trump tried to stop lawmakers from certifying that Democrat Joe Biden had defeated Trump in last November's election. Federal authorities previously said they would not pursue criminal charges against the officer. The United Nations warned Monday that Yemen is no closer to peacefully resolving its civil war. More than 6 years of war have pushed the Middle East's poorest country to the brink. While food is available in the country's markets, people can no longer afford it. The UN Children's Agency says the situation of children is particularly dire. U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris spoke of what she called a shared vision of a free and open Indo-Pacific region, and she visited Singapore at the start of her short trip to Southeast Asia. Harris is scheduled to meet Tuesday with business leaders in Singapore as part of a joint effort to shore up supply chains. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. There are concerns of a new wave of public violence in South Africa this week. Security forces say that they're on high alert after pamphlets and social media messages spread around the country this weekend calling for mass protests. The calls apparently emanate from KwaZulu-Natal, the home province of former President Jacob Zuma. Mobs began looting stores and destroying infrastructure in several cities last month, killing about 350 people. And causing billions of dollars in damage. This is after Zuma was jailed for contempt of court. Darren Taylor has that story.
Thousands of police and soldiers are hitting the streets to prevent possible outbreaks of violence. The biggest deployments are in Gauteng and KwaZulu-Natal. A few weeks ago, the worst public unrest since the end of apartheid in 1994 happened in these two provinces, in which the two major cities of Johannesburg and Durban are situated. Police Ministry spokesperson Liranzu Temba says law enforcement agencies have put measures in place to protect citizens who accused the police of doing little to stop last month's mayhem. In a recorded message to media, Temba said this time, the security agencies, collectively known as the National Joint Operations and Intelligence Structure, or NAT joints, are ready for anything.
The NAT joints is aware of inflammatory messages on various social media platforms advocating for violence. Those behind these messages are warned that inciting violence is a criminal offense. Members of the public are cautioned against spreading such divisive messages.
According to the NAT Joint's operational plan, seen by VOA, security forces will guard national key points such as airports and the state broadcaster, along with police stations, prisons, and shopping centers. Some of the pamphlets accuse President Cyril Ramaphosa of selling out the poor by favoring white capitalists. Temba says other messages urge citizens to shut the country down.
The public is urged not to respond to calls for violence and criminality and are thus discouraged from participating in activities that seek to defy the rule of law and to undermine the authority of the state.
The African National Congress, or ANC, in KwaZulu-Natal makes no secret of its support for Zuma, who's accused of mass corruption. ANC Provincial Representative Nhlakanipho Ntombela acknowledges that some of the pamphlets bear what appears to be the stamp of the ANC Provincial Office.
We've been aware of a pamphlet circulating and want to put it on record that as the ANC in KwaZulu-Natal were not party to any of those activities. Those who have done that thing, they've done on their own. They're with not authority of the ANC in the province.
Ntombela says just because the ANC in the province backs Zuma doesn't mean it's trying to destabilize the Ramaphosa government.
we can assure the people of South Africa, we don't know who is organizing and who is behind it. In fact, we are warning those individuals that using an ANC logo on an illegal activity is a criminal offense against the organization.
He says the ANC in KwaZulu-Natal would never advocate violence to achieve a political objective in a democratic country.
It can't be done on the ANC name. Whereas if you understood what happened during the last incident of looting and everything, it can't be done in the name of the former President Zuma.
In July, law enforcement agencies ignored social media messages inciting violence until it was too late. Not this time, says Temba.
Law-abiding citizens should be at ease knowing that the NetJoint is not taking these threats lightly. Security forces are on high alert and are ready to maintain stability in the country and will ensure the safety and security of South Africans.
Meanwhile, it's taken more than a month for Ramaphosa to say what citizens have known all along, that his administration was poorly prepared for last month's attempted insurrection, as he describes it. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
And finally, the 2020 Paralympic Games begin in Tokyo, Tuesday, August 24th. That's where the Paralympians will compete in a total of 22 different sporting activities. Aaron Fedor visited an athlete in Princeton, New Jersey, who speaks about his personal journey, breaking down barriers, and the importance of redefining how people look at disability.
I'm incredibly proud to be a part of the Paralympic movement, and it is gaining more and more attention and gaining more and more steam, not only in the U.S., but globally. I think it's critically important, really as a societal thing, to look at how we can reframe the way that we look at disability. The reaction of my friends and family to my blindness was that they couldn't imagine what my life was going to be like, and they just feel sorry for me. Paralympics offers us an opportunity to get excited about wheelchair racing or get excited about blind athletes tearing down a ski slope or riding a tandem bike at 30, 40 miles an hour. I think it's a really important sort of mechanism to have a real positive, cathartic conversation within our society about disability. And I'm just so proud that not only are our Paralympic athletes doing incredible things at the Paralympics themselves, but then that carries out and permeates through our society in a positive way. So for about 7 years, I was an explosive ordnance disposal officer in the Navy. I deployed both to Iraq and to Afghanistan during that time period. On September 7th, 2011, I was part of an assault team that was doing combat operations in the Kandahar province of Afghanistan. At about 7:30 in the morning, I stepped on an improvised explosive device that detonated about a foot and a half in front of me. The really good news is I was able to walk away from that blast. The bad news is, as a result of the blast injuries I sustained to my face, I lost my vision permanently. And I'm normally a pretty upbeat, positive person. I like to be a leader in my community, and I didn't like that everybody's reaction to me was that of pity. So I was looking for an opportunity to show everyone in action that this diagnosis of blindness was not going to get me down. I kind of want to be the best at everything, whether it's making pizza or competing in the Paralympic triathlon. I think this notion of excellence really motivates me. I don't think it's... When you use the word competitive, for me, it's not necessarily competitive. I'm not looking to beat other people. I'm looking to do something in an excellent way, in the most excellent way. By virtue of achieving that level of excellence, I have to beat other people. What I'm trying to achieve is excellence. And I like that. I like having that mindset because on the race course, I'm kind of cheering for everybody else too. I want them to be excellent. I want them to be their most excellent self. I just also want my most excellent self to be better than their excellent self, if that makes any sense.
And this has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events. You can do so at our website, voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.